In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Welcome. Glad you're joining us here today on the I Spy Radio Show. Every week, helping you get a little more intelligence on big government. And once again, we are definitely seeing big government at work. As we said last week, big government is flexing its muscles to close down huge elements of society and the economy. This week, we continue that with doing what big government loves best, spending money, in an effort to fix the problem that big government created, shutting down huge parts of society and the economy. You know, markets are really interesting things because they reflect the perceptions of the millions of people in them far more efficiently than any government planner could ever do. In 1906, Sir Francis Dalton, a statistician, went to a county fair, and there was this contest asking people to guess the weight of an ox. Being a wonky stats guy, he analyzed the guesses afterwards. He found out that out of 787 guesses, the guesses were all over the place, with no one guess being correct. But when taken together, the median guess was extremely accurate, within 0.8% of the true weight of the ox. He went on to study this and found it to be remarkably consistent. This became known as the wisdom of the crowd, a phenomenon where the cumulative median estimate of a group is more accurate than any individual member of that group or even of experts. Essentially, the collective guess of a group tends to be more accurate than guesses by individuals within the group. It's why the stock market so accurately reflects the larger economy. Big government, on the other hand, uses a small group of experts to make decisions for large groups of people. And that's why government planners or experts just aren't as accurate as markets. We have small groups of scientists who have pushed global warming, which government officials use as the evidence to push climate change agendas, including multi-billion dollar economic policies. Now, breaking on Friday, the small group of scientists that worked the world into a frothing frenzy with apocalyptic predictions about the coronavirus are suddenly walking back their predictions. The team out of Imperial College in the UK had initially predicted 500,000 deaths in the UK. Now they're saying it's likely only going to be about 20,000. That is not a rounding error. That is a panic-mongering overestimate, 25 times the new figures. Think of it this way. What would you do, how would you feel, if someone swore to you a property was worth $100,000 and you bought it, and then come to find out it was only worth $4,000? There are going to be a lot of questions on the other side of this virus. And speaking of questions, we have a ton of them for today's guests about the markets, about the $2 trillion aid package that was just passed, what this economic shutdown will do to states who just passed their own budgets back when things were looking good. Are we going to be able to avoid economic disaster? And a whole lot more, maybe even a little myth-busting. I'd like to welcome Jonathan Williams back to the show. He is the chief economist at ALEC, that's the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, it's great to talk to you again.
Always good to be with you, Mark. And as I always say, greetings from the land of make-believe here in Washington. And if it used to be a funny laugh line, and now it's actually very serious, unfortunately, with all the silly season here.
Oh, my word. It has just been unbelievable. In fact, I think this may be the first time ever that we've spoken to you twice in a single quarter. I mean, who can believe it was just a month ago that when we talked to you? And back then, it was Kate Brown trying to sabotage timber unity and the whole carbon tax debate. And now here we are just a month later, the coronavirus hits and the bottom falls out of the market. And in fact, that's really where I'd like to start with you and start with something that has really been bothering me the last few weeks. Why didn't they close the markets when they began to tank? I mean, we did this after 9/11, just suspend all trading, let people breathe, calm down, digest the news, and just stop the bleeding.
Well, that's an interesting question. As all of us kind of look at the equities space and our overall investment portfolios internally, and I encourage everybody that's a long-term investor to, you know, probably put aside that first quarter 401k statement, because our 401ks might be 201ks after the last few weeks here in the market. But I do think that, you know, China, you know, because of Chinese New Year's, you know, had their markets are closed there for a period of time. And that probably in the end of the day did them some good in kind of getting over this kind of the first wave of fear that hit everyone, which was certainly the health fears and then, you know, the compounding economic fears on top of it. And it, of course, feeds on itself in some cases is a vicious cycle. And so some market commentators that I read frequently, you know, were making the case that, you know, China was better off because of that. And, you know, there may be some benefit for the U.S. to consider that in the future, as you mentioned with 9/11. You know, that being said, on the other side of the argument, and I guess I am somewhat agnostic on this point personally, is that, you know, you've got to deal with the music at some point. And clearly people were thinking that equities were overvalued and we had had an incredible run up, as you and I have talked about several times, over 10 years now of recovery that really accelerated because of tax cuts and deregulatory actions in Washington and many of the state capitals. And so people quite, I think, rightly wanted to take their profits in some cases and want to, you know, analyze the market for what was next. And let's all hope that now, I think once the fear stage is behind us, I think that we can all come in, and we've seen some very positive recent trends in equities suggesting that we may be in line for some sort of a rally. And that would be obviously very welcome news for all savers and investors out there. And by the way, for those pension systems across the country that are so underfunded.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's going to be something I think we'll talk a little bit more about in a later segment there. It was just amazing to watch that free fall, that it wiped out the entire gains of Trump's 3 years in the span of about 3 weeks. I just never expected to see that sort of thing short of an alien invasion or an actual attack by actual Russians. Some of what I think we had seen, though, were some overreactions. You had mentioned that, you know, a lot of people had thought that the stocks were overvalued. I think there's some truth to that, but the overall fundamentals were very strong. It wasn't like the Obama economy, where pretty much the only place where you could put money and make any money was the stock market. So everybody just threw money at the stock markets. And so I think you just had overinflated stock prices. But in terms of the overreactions, I think we're seeing that a lot on state levels. I mean, here in Oregon, the governor has just basically shut down everything for a very minor number of cases. We actually have somebody that's been in contact with us. She's been going around to some parking lots where they've set up these testing sites. They're completely empty. Nobody's using them. And so why are we shutting down the whole state for, you know, 100 some cases or so, whatever it is? And I think that's what this crisis really shows, that given the chance, big government can and will destroy the economy, even if they have really good intentions while doing so. And what we're seeing to me, anyway, demonstrates what a terribly poor understanding government officials, especially Democrat governors like our own Governor Kate, have of basic economics or even business principles. It's almost like they think money magically appears in businesses' bank accounts with no real effort by the businesses. Have you seen that same thing, or do you have a different take?
Well, I'll tell you, this we are certainly living in that line of the Chinese proverb that may you live in interesting times. And these are certainly unforeseen times that, you know, many of us have never lived through anything like this. And so it creates a really interesting dynamic, and a very, in some cases, terrifying dynamic, as you mentioned, for small business. But how do you balance, you know, real health concerns and health needs? And, you know, some of the places here in Washington, D.C. area, where we have, I think, something like 1,000 plus confirmed cases, or New York, where it's even worse, where you have some really big challenges. And then how do you balance that with, you know, areas across the United States that are not seeing anything nearly acute? And I think here's where I kind of rest on this is federalism works, and we should allow it to work to some degree, or I should say in great degree. So I'm very happy that President Trump is allowing governors and states to take more of a leadership position instead of just nationalizing the discussion on this and ordering all businesses closed from a national perspective. That's point one. I think that's healthy that he's allowed states to govern. Now you get into the other point, though, that you're making, which is in states that don't have a severe outbreak, you know, why is it that governors like Governor Brown are making these kind of draconian authoritarian guidelines? And I've heard from some Oregon legislators directly about this, to say that rural Oregon, for instance, is going to be crushed by these type of statewide orders for one size fits all. So you have the same dynamic at the state level with these one size fits all policies that create real hardship for small businesses. And I think at the end of the day, that's where my personal biggest concern is right now. Are these mom and pops, are these entrepreneurial success stories that may be in families for generations, are they going to be able to reopen their doors once they've been ordered shut by a big government?
Yeah, I think that's going to be really fascinating to see. All right, Todd, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up next, we'll be discussing the government's response and dissect that aid package for Americans that Nancy grudgingly agreed to vote on. Stay with us. Talk today to Jonathan Williams. He's the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. You can visit their website at alec.org. We'll link that up on ispyradio.com. And Jonathan, I'd like to talk to you in this segment a little bit about the bailout that has come out. We've got the aid package now that Nancy had initially held hostage for a left-wing wish list of demands that had absolutely nothing to do with the coronavirus. I mean, I tell you, I've never been so disgusted with Democrats as I was when she did that. But let's talk a second, though, about the Trump administration's response to the coronavirus as it rolled out. Overall, how would you grade President Trump's response to all of this?
Well, I'll tell you, in recent days, in recent weeks now, the amount of information that I've been seeing come out of this administration, and I know a lot of it's directed at state and local officials, so they can be taking that information and passing along to their constituents and their departments of health and, you know, different regulatory agencies and things like that. It's been really, the flow of information has been incredible. And I do think that the president and his heads of agencies deserve a whole lot of credit for the information flow that they're continuously sending out to interested parties and to his messages to the American public of late that have just been, I think, very reassuring and kind of, you know, going through and making sure people are up to date on, as these facts change almost on a minute by minute basis, it seems, as we're aware of not only the facts on the ground, but the administration's responses. And, you know, I think that when we talk about the federal idea set that's being talked about now, whether it's the package that came out of the Senate that's headed back over to the House, or its previous editions of the stimulus or bailout, however you'd like to characterize those. These are very weighty issues, of course. And, you know, here's one of the things that I like to harken back to is, you know, I actually just heard Art Laffer the other day and his commentary on what's happening. And he reminded me of what Ronald Reagan had said to a young staffer who came, I think, during the SNL crisis of the 80s and asked, you know, what do we need to do? And Reagan, you know, in his usual manner, responded by saying, don't just sit there, we go undo something. And so instead of like this do something disease that oftentimes infects, and sometimes there's good rationale for having to do something, but, you know, oftentimes, especially during an election season like we're in, is creating a new law, creating a new regulation as part of a response to a crisis can be some of the most dangerous responses. And so I think we need to kind of go back to that Reagan mentality, which is, you know, not often, even though the government may take action, we don't need to add new laws and new regulations in many cases to the books. Let's figure out how we provide people regulatory flexibility and tax relief and some of the things that will get this economy moving again and get those small businesses that we were just talking about that are suffering because of these government ordered shutdowns, get them to a place where they'll be able to open their doors again.
You had mentioned that we're moving a lot of these regulations, but can you just imagine where we'd be if Trump hadn't already removed tens of thousands of regulations? I mean, we are such a leaner government right now that if you're trying to undo those at the same time that you're then dealing with this coronavirus, I mean, you'd just be mind-boggling. But thankfully, he spent the last 3 years untangling so much of that. And, you know, thank goodness for that. So the Senate did pass an aid package unanimously for Americans, and the House did follow suit. I'm uncomfortable a lot of times with federal bailouts, and yet this was an unprecedented economic collapse. As we said, it wiped out the gains over the last 3 years in about 3 weeks. Details are still coming out of the 800-some page bill, but what's your overall take on the assistance package? Did they mostly get it right?
Well, there's obviously there's some things in the package, and obviously it may change between the time that we start this interview and the time that we end this interview. But it's moving that quickly. But, you know, I think that there's some very much some good things for concerned taxpayers across the country. There's some things that are very concerning for taxpayers across the country in any of these big packages, whether you're looking at a normal appropriates package or omnibus or these type of kind of crisis related measures. Is there's going to be positives, there's going to be negatives. And I do think, you know, there are some things there, like, for instance, one of the most important things that had already been talked about by Treasury and the IRS is, why in the world would we want tax day to continue to be April 15th when we need families taking care of their own and businesses trying to stay afloat versus worrying about compliance and worrying about paying their tax bill from last year, which was a very profitable year for many people. And so why hit them with that burden right now? So the package for one of the things is it puts their July 15th as the new tax filing and tax payment deadline. I think pushing it back that far is a very good step. I'd like to personally even see it probably further to give businesses more cash flow and liquidity to deal with some of the issues they've got to deal with right now and stay afloat. But I think that's a very positive. Another one is net operating losses. This has been something that of all the positives that we've talked about of federal tax reform in recent years, one area that probably needed to be readdressed was the net operating loss provision, which we're going to see lots of people probably have sizable losses this year, and it would allow them to apply those losses against previous profits that they made in order to get that liquidity back into the business and see that kind of a refund. So I think there's some very positive things there. There's lots of other things too that are positive. And then you look at the other side of it, and there's some real warning signs, including the headline that I just saw recently, which was Secretary Mnuchin at Treasury suggesting that the federal government would take some sort of an ownership equity position, yes, in the airlines if they were given this grant as, yeah, part of the stimulus or bailout package. That's a very concerning idea from a free market perspective, and it really is one that shocked me in how poorly thought out it was.
Yeah, in fact, I'd like to talk to you about that when we come back, because that was concerning to me as well. Anyone stay with us. We'll have more with Jonathan Williams talking about the bailout that the government just pushed through. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Talk today to Jonathan Williams. He's the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President of Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, a great site. They have great policies for you to go through, and they're actually looking for information and feedback right now in terms of what states ought to be doing. So, Jonathan, just real quick on that note, I know that you guys were looking for ideas and stuff of what the states and the federal government ought to be doing. Have you gotten very much feedback on that?
Well, it's been great to see the amount of feedback from legislators and from businesses all across the country who are saying, you know, what would be helpful to them in this really this strange time that we're living in. And, a lot of what we're hearing is exactly what we've been talking about, which is instead of government giving me something, what are the things that government can be taken away in terms of barriers to me staying afloat as a business and regulation, and how can government lower its tax burden and things like that. And it's been very, very positive to see. And, you know, obviously as an organization who believes firmly in the principle, the American bedrock principle of federalism, you know, we believe that some things will be pointed at Washington, D.C., but hopefully the vast majority of things will be pointed at the state and local levels of government that can provide solutions at that level, which will be obviously much more responsive to the needs of businesses and individuals.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be really interesting to see all of this unfold as we come out of this. I think so much of the solutions are going to, once again, is so often true in life, is getting government out of the way rather than getting more government. So in that last segment there, we were talking about shares of stocks and companies, when this aid packages were first being bandied about, some of the on the left loved the idea that maybe the U.S., the federal government ought to start buying up shares of companies, and they really thought it would be a chance to swoop in and government grab control of some of these companies. On the other side, as you mentioned, there's been some discussion from Trump advisors that perhaps maybe some of these loans and the aid packages could take the forms of buying shares in a company. The idea being, I guess, is that once the shares go up in value and the company is on the mend, that the government could then sell the shares at a profit recouping some of that initial aid and then making some money on the deal, which, you know, in theory sounds good. But I get really squeamish about the government taking a stake in these companies. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, for all of us who believe in a free market, free enterprise environment, this should be, I think, a huge threat to our future functioning of a free marketplace in the United States, of having a government, whether it's a state or federal government, take ownership of companies, whether it's an equity stake or however you want to structure it. You know, obviously, we don't want to create, you know, dramatic parallels to what's gone on in other countries that are much further down the line when it comes to government control and command economies. However, you do have to, you know, in the back of your head, think through the slippery slope argument, which is, in times of crisis, government comes in and, you know, maybe takes some ownership of certain companies here, another industry there. And, you know, how long does it take then? And then this becomes the norm, or in any point of crisis,
right.
And this is being done on a bipartisan basis right now. What if we have a real progressive in office that says, well, yep. If even this is a bipartisan deal to take ownership of companies, why don't we just nationalize the industry, right?
Yeah.
And you do have to kind of think through the huge detrimental long-term effects of even that kind of a small shift in policymaking.
Yeah, that notion of the slippery slope. What about the idea of maybe could you issue a special class of stock, like, for example, that would have non-voting shares just for the government to purchase? Would something like that work?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't know. I mean, is it a core function of government to have an arbitrage feature in which they hope to make money off of, you know, being part of distressed companies and then selling at a profit later on? I tend to think it's pretty clearly not. It's not. I'm somewhat familiar enough with the Constitution, or at least stayed at a Holiday Inn recently enough to know that, you know, that is not the kind of role that our founders envisioned for the federal
yes.
government or any level of government in the United States. And so I think that precedent does it worries me. The other thing, which is a slight correction to what you said earlier, and at least my reading of the situation, is these are not going to be loans. These are going to be structured as grants to companies. And so I think it's one thing to loan and get, you know, companies through a liquidity situation and have that paid back. We can have an argument over that policy outcome, but having a grant and a specific, you know, government check issued without any obligation of repayment takes it to a whole nother level as well.
Well, I thought that the grants were mainly for small businesses, but the larger corporations, it was more of a loan type of situation. But, you know,
it is evolving as we go. So
yes.
It may be right on that front. Let's hope it's more of a loan situation than it is a complete bailout.
Yeah. I know that we had somebody on from Timber Unity last week, and she was saying that because she was on a phone call with the president and some White House officials, that they were saying that as far as small businesses were concerned, that the aid was going to take the form of a grant if you use that money to keep employees whole or to pay for overhead, that sort of thing. If you use it for other things, then it was going to be considered a loan that would have to be paid back. So, but like you say, it's constantly evolving, and we may not know until after they pass it. One of those situations. One of the things that I did find a little troubling when they're first talking about a potential aid package was the Democrats were immediately pushing for more money to bail out states, not people in those states, but to bail out state governments. And I know here in Oregon, the very first thing that both our U.S. senators and our governor said was, we need more money. Not we need more information before we take appropriate actions, just we need more money. And that seemed really suspiciously odd to me. I mean, what do you make of that? Was this a way to use federal government to bail out bad state-level overspending that happened prior to the virus?
I think, unfortunately, the answer to that is yes. And this has been something I've spent a whole lot of time thinking and writing about over the years. And I've been doing this long enough, as you know, Mark, that I was kind of a thorn in the side of the idea of bailing out the states with the Obama-era stimulus
yeah.
package coming out of the Great Recession of 2008 and into 2009 when they passed that. And I thought it was a huge moral hazard problem, as we say, which is rewarding bad behavior at the state level. We've had this really unprecedented run-up in the economy over the last 10 years, but more specifically in the last 3 to 4, and states have had now for 3, 4, 5 years running setting a new record level of revenue collections every single year at the 50-state broad level. Some states are not quite there. Oregon struggled a little bit, I know, as we've talked about in that regard. But there's been some historically high revenue gains. So what did the states do with that? Is in many cases, they didn't follow the fiscally prudent advice of putting away something for a rainy day. They didn't, let's say, restock their unemployment insurance funds the way that they should be after that many good years. And now all of a sudden, after 10 good years of a run-up, in at least in equities and, somewhat less than that for revenues, now all of a sudden, after a few weeks of a very bad situation, states are saying that they're completely broke. There's something that doesn't ring true to me about that, where we see Andrew Cuomo and Newsom in California and your governor and others kind of out there with their hands out saying we need federal cash because oh so poor state government, when it's really the individuals and the businesses of the states, obviously, that we need to be most concerned about.
That's right. Absolutely. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, we'll be talking some more about this aid package and maybe do a little myth busting. Stay with us. And welcome back. Talking about the coronavirus pandemic that's been going on here, especially in terms of the panic in the markets and now this new aid package that has come out. We're analyzing that with Jonathan Williams. He's the chief economist and executive vice president of policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. You can visit their website at alec.org, and we'll link that up on ispyradio.com as well. And so, Jonathan, looking at this aid package, if Jonathan Williams or ALEC had been in charge, what would have been the right kind of assistance? I mean, was there something else that could have been done and should have been done?
Well, hindsight being 2020 and being an armchair quarterback is obviously much, much easier than what our elected officials had to go through over the last week or two up here on Capitol Hill and in the White House. So I don't want it to seem like we're disparaging their, efforts, and they put in a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into this final package and negotiating things. And so if I were able to, kind of raise the wand and say, what does a free market success look like? I think there's a few things that were probably not discussed nearly enough. And let's put it that way, in that, I will have an op-ed coming out shortly talking about things like, there's some regulatory pieces that in all the success of the Trump administration on deregulation, they hadn't tackled a couple of big ones that I think have a huge effect on economy, getting people back to work, and by the way, giving state and local governments a whole lot of relief on the cost of producing new infrastructure projects. And that is the Davis-Bacon Law, which, as you know from studying things, Mark, that was now on the books for nearly 100 years. And it's a law that adds tremendously to the cost of construction projects at the both the federal and the state and local level. It's been something that's kind of been a holy grail for big labor. They've used that effectively for their organizing purposes. But if you look back at the history books, it's been something that during at least times of economic crisis or natural disasters, that presidents of both parties, including both Bush presidents, President Nixon, and by the way, FDR himself, have suspended the Davis-Bacon federal law for prevailing wage for construction because of economic hardship. FDR did it in the midst of the depression in the 30s, and then was done around some of the hurricanes, most recently with George W. Bush. But it's a way that could save taxpayers billions of dollars, put many more people back to work. Some estimates say upwards of 150,000 if Davis-Bacon were repealed and new construction-related jobs. That seems to be a massive opportunity for good public policy that benefits everybody, but also is really kind of tailored to helping state and local projects and infrastructure and getting people back to work. That's one. I think another one would be roughly the 100-year-old Jones Act, which is something that I know you've probably studied as well, being an astute study of economics and policy, Mark. And that's something that adds tremendously to the cost of goods, especially in places like Hawaii and Alaska. We saw it suspended with the hurricane and the recovery efforts in Puerto Rico by President Trump himself. But it, for a state like Alaska, which right now at the price of oil being just over $20 a barrel and with cruise line tourism being shut down for the foreseeable future, that could be the kind of thing that could provide a real deregulatory lifeline for states like Alaska and Hawaii and benefit all American consumers. And then I think just broadly speaking, I think we've got to look at things like, you know, once we get through this crisis, how do we tackle the sovereign debt crisis, if you will, with the national debt at 23 plus trillion, adding now hundreds of billions, if not a couple of trillion to that, as well as just the overall spending growth that we've seen at the federal level. That's something that we need to address after we get through this crisis.
Mm-hmm. And again, it just sounds like a lot of the solutions right now is getting government out of the way and really just letting business do what it does, which is find the best, cheapest way to do things. And yet at the same time, make profits. Speaking of profits, I'd like to spend a little bit of time here doing some myth busting. And, you know, I don't like some of the strings attached to the funding that we're hearing about in particular, because it creates this sort of blanket controls over how individual companies are allowed to spend the money that they're about to receive. For example, a company might be, you know, going into this crisis, they may have been just at that, you know, point of being overstaffed, especially now. So given the current situation, and maybe they have high debts that they accumulated while ramping up productions while the times were good and the outlook was good. Maybe now instead they could really use that federal aid money to pay down debt, but they've been told they can only spend it on certain things. And a lot of the strings in this aid package came from Democrats who seem to dislike business to begin with. So let's maybe start with some little bit of myth busting here. One of which was that they shouldn't be allowed to buy back their own stocks. What does it mean for a company when they buy back their own stocks? Are companies merely enriching themselves and making greedy executives even richer?
Well, what they do is they buy back stock, and then obviously that would help support the price of the stock. So it's not just for the individual company, but for all the shareholders, obviously have a big benefit there. But, you know, I think that I was reading one investor talking about this very thing the other day. And, you know, we for a long time have incentivized companies to get on the debt financing track because of the tax advantages. And this is something studying corporate finance a long time ago in business school I learned. And, you know, we incentivize that. And then we are surprised when, you know, people get too far into debt, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is another way for companies to use dollars. And I think it's kind of a big government solution, obviously, whenever you're giving money out and then putting the strings attached. And I think it distorts the marketplace. Whether you think it's good policy or not for an individual company to be using dollars to buy back their shares, or whether that's something their CEO has to answer to the corporate board and to shareholders over, obviously. And individually, companies by individual companies are going to have different solution sets on what works best for them. But anytime you come in with the command and control approach from the federal government to say you must not take this one avenue, it distorts the marketplace even further than we have just based on incentivizing debt financing over equity in the past.
Yeah. And another myth I think that's consistently out there is that, at least as far as some of these Democrats are concerned, is that profits are bad. And I just continue to be blown away by the fact that a lot of people can think that somehow profits are bad or that excessive profits are bad. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as I learned from accounting 101 back in business school, here is profit is not a dirty word, although some people certainly think it is today. Yes. And it's one of those things where I don't know where kind of the left thinks, does money just grow on trees or where does it come from? And if you want companies to invest, where does that come from? It comes from profitability, right? How do you invest in new capital expenditures? How do you invest in hiring new people or giving people better benefits or raises or bonuses? Where does that come from? It comes from your cash flow. It comes from being a profitable enterprise. If you're losing money, you're not hiring. You're not giving people bonuses. You're not giving people better compensation on healthcare, for instance. So I think there's this massive disconnect. We're demonizing profits, but at the same time, wanting businesses to do what's good for business anyways, that is take care of their employees.
Yes, absolutely. And they could not take care of their employees unless they had those profits. I don't know where they think profits come from either. I guess it's from leprechauns carrying bags of gold, riding unicorns across rainbow bridges. Who knows? Anyway, when we come back, the state's responses and what they're in for. More with Jonathan Williams. Back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today to Jonathan Williams. He's the Chief Economist and the Executive Vice President of Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. You can visit them at alec.org. Great resources for you to help understand free markets, but also if you're a legislator, they have all sorts of policies that you can just dig right into to help your state. And the states really do need some help right now, because apparently here in Oregon, this notion that apparently we can just close everything and somehow that will make things okay. Here in Oregon, we have just over 300 cases in a state with over 4 million people, and we've shut down the whole state for that. What are your thoughts on the responses that you're seeing from some of these governors on how to deal with all of this?
Well, I do think, Mark, that it raises a big question in my mind that some have asked me about. I don't have an adequate response at this point, which is, if government is coming in and mandating businesses shut their doors for, in some cases, an extended period of time, what kind of recourse does that business have against the government? Does it owe that business? Is that a taking under the Fifth Amendment, you know, the Constitution? Or is there some sort of damage that is then created? Clearly there is. And then what is that business owed in terms of some sort of legal challenge to what this looks like going on? I do think that there is a really legitimate case that businesses are going to have to say, you forced us to stop operating. You deemed us non-essential. Yeah. We had to go through to try to appeal that. In some cases, there's that process in some states.
Yes.
And what does that look like in terms of being held whole after this is
behind us?
And will it matter if the business isn't there?
Yeah, that has really been one of my questions going forward through all of this is, are you going to see a whole bunch of businesses go into bankruptcy? And then are they going to just be able to turn around and sue the state? And I mean, you could be talking billions of dollars of lawsuits.
There's a big liability out there. We talk a lot about unfunded liabilities when it comes to pensions and other things. This is one that I don't know enough people are talking about or thinking about when they're making these broad-based orders that cover areas that are not being hard hit, as you pointed out, in places in Oregon, for instance. So that's one thing I think that we really have to watch from a policy perspective. You know, but we've seen some very interesting state responses where governors are being very good about looking at ways to kind of waive state-level rules and regulations that would stop people and businesses from operating how they need to under the circumstance. You know, one of which is something super, you know, straightforward, but, you know, Governor Sununu in New Hampshire, live free or die, love their state motto in New Hampshire. He actually just decided that so many people are being forced to do takeouts as people are not allowed to eat in restaurants. Then why would they have a regulation that says you can't get a beer or wine item with your food as part of takeout? That wasn't allowed before. It's not allowed in many states. And now that's the kind of waiver that governors are kind of thinking to meet people where they're at with having to eat their food at home. And so we're seeing some great regulatory relief. We're seeing occupational licensing rules, for instance, being either suspended, waived, changed, to especially for the medical profession to say in some cases one day and you'll have reciprocity and be able to practice medicine in a state and be part of that really needed response to what's going on to deal with the health challenges that we do. Why in the world would we put up these kind of bureaucratic barriers where we need more health workers coming in, maybe from states that are not nearly as affected and going to places like New York or D.C. or others? So those are just of a few. And then we're seeing states also shift their own state tax filing deadlines to meet the federal. In some cases, they may go further. And I think that's a very welcome relief right now where people can just put that on hold. If it's like me, I always kind of wait until the last minute and dread the kind of paperwork burden and the complexity that you have to go through to make sure you're not violating any laws when you're filing your income tax. Hopefully now states will all follow the federal government on that to give people that much needed peace of mind.
Yes, and I think I did hear that they either announced or were planning to announce that they are going to push Oregon's tax day back There's also some discussion about delaying the implementation of Oregon's latest corporate sales tax, the business sales tax. We'll see if that happens. Have these states that have just decided to shutter the entire state, you know, keep everybody at home in lockdown, California for certain, you know, here in Oregon as well, have these states begun to think about what they're going to do on the other side of this? I mean, with all of these businesses effectively out of business, that's going to come around and hit government hard in tax collections, you know, once this is all through. Aren't state budgets, many of which were just passed, that were based on a booming economy, aren't they suddenly going to have a world of hurt on the other side of this?
Well, they're going to be massively in trouble at the state level for states like California. I just saw a report that not only with the current budget, but you know, CalPERS, the largest pension system there in California, has reportedly lost in the tens of billions in recent weeks in the market, as you can imagine, on top of the current budget. But, you know, for the states, and many states had already adjourned for the year before this really hit. So their budgets are now based on assumptions that were very rosy, perhaps even for good times. And now for bad times, I think we're going to see a whole slew of states come back and actually have special sessions to have to deal with the differences between assumptions and reality. And that's going to be dangerous time. No sugarcoating that, Mark. That's going to be dangerous times for taxpayers, because there's going to be this short-term need to raise revenue in some people's minds, and they're not going to think about the economic damage in some cases that that's going to just exacerbate.
Well, I think it's definitely going to exacerbate a lot of problems, because in Democrat states, they tend to say, oh, well, we're short of money, therefore we just need to raise more taxes, rather than what you normally see on the Republican side is, okay, we're short on taxes, we're short on funds, so we need to cut taxes to encourage more growth. I think going forward, you know, the old 50 test tubes of democracy there. I think this is going to be really fascinating to watch this unfold. Let's go ahead and take a break there, and we'll have more with Jonathan Williams coming up. We'll be talking about the media's response on all of this and also looking ahead at the future. Stay with us. And welcome back. Wrapping things up here on the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Jonathan Williams, the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President of Policy at ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council. And Jonathan, in the time that we have left here with you, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the media here and its role. I kind of think that a lot of the initial panic in the markets was driven largely by the media. And in fact, I really think they were actively cheering for a downturn when this all first started. But I'm hearing some economists that are already saying that we're already in a recession, which is a little odd because normally recession is two consecutive quarters of a downturn. In fact, what do you make of Federal Chairman Powell on NBC's Today show saying on Thursday that we may already be in a recession? I don't see that as helpful right now.
Yeah, you have to. I do question some of these comments from some of the economic talking heads out there that are clearly getting ahead of themselves. I think in some cases where even bending the definition of what is to your point, Mark, of what a recession is, you know, the Atlanta Fed recently came out with its projections for quarter one, and it was still, you know, in the positive. In fact, it was still kind of in the 2.5 to 3% range that we may end up the first quarter. Now that still may be optimistic, but I think it's very plausible to say you get out of the first quarter with a positive GDP number, and then the second quarter would be the quarter that you take the biggest hit because of all these forced shutdowns and everyone's responses to the health side of the crisis. And
right.
So I think just people have to be awfully careful about language right now, in that the vast majority of people may not study the textbook definition of what a recession looks like. And to have someone like the head of the Federal Reserve go out there and kind of throw that out there, I think is a little bit misleading.
I certainly thought so, too. In terms of the comeback, we've only got about 3 minutes here with you. In terms of the comeback, what's the future look like? How soon do you think that we can get back on our feet?
Well, I'm glad you asked it, because something you mentioned earlier is exactly right on point, and that is I am bullish about the future of the American economy because of the fundamentals that we have in place. You know, let's face it, this was somewhat of a black swan event in the marketplace that caused this huge sell-off in equities. And of course, it has now created this, you know, with the health scare, getting people out of the workplace, in some cases, as you point out, maybe overly draconian by government order. And so I think based on the kind of competitiveness of the U.S. economy versus the rest of the world, I think we're actually in a very good place to rebound fairly quickly once we can get kind of the panic and the fear and the health crisis kind of abated. I think our American economy is set to go back on growth mode fairly quickly. It's obviously impossible with a crystal ball to project when that's going to happen. I think once you see a leveling off of some of the cases and you see that the health professionals are able to really tackle this from an infrastructure perspective, I think you've already seen the market in equities as a leading indicator start to react much better in the last couple of days. And I think the fundamentals of lower taxes and the deregulatory agenda of the Trump administration have put us in a place that we are going to be very well positioned versus some of our competitors around the world.
Well, one of the things that the Democrats and Republicans could never get pushed forward was something that Trump has been pushing, and certainly the Democrats say they've been pushing, which is this infrastructure deal. Do you see something like that coming out of this, you know, kind of like an FDR New Deal type thing where they suddenly have all of these road and bridge and everything else projects?
Well, that's an interesting question. And, you know, I tend to think that obviously there's a real need in many cases for better infrastructure. I think we have to be awfully careful how we structure it so taxpayers are getting a good deal and we're getting rid of costly regulations like we talked about earlier with Davis-Bacon that could give us so much more bang for the buck on construction of infrastructure. And, you know, even giving it to the states and letting states run with it and getting more federal involvement kind of taken out as part of this in the bureaucracy and the overhead costs and allowing states to be much more frugal with the construction dollars. I think there's a big opportunity there. I think, you know, for those that just wanted as a Keynesian stimulus piece, I think you got to be somewhat careful in that, you know, those projects in many cases because of permitting and other things take a long time to get started. So we'll be well into recovery before many of those projects ever break ground, like the so-called, you know, projects during the Obama administration on shovel ready that were some are still kind of in the works. So I think it's a balancing act there. But I think if the federal government does it right, gives the states the tools to do it and rids kind of this costly regulation as a rider to the transportation projects and infrastructure, I think that would be the best course of action.
Yeah. Well, if the government's going to spend a bunch of money, it'd be nice to at least get a few new roads out of it. That's for sure. Jonathan Williams, thanks again so much for your time. And boy, hold on to your hat because I don't think we're out of this little storm just yet, but at least it feels like we're getting there.
Well, thanks, my friend. It's the light at the end of the tunnel, I think.
Absolutely. Here in Oregon, we have a state that is being run by somebody that has never run a business. She was a lobbyist for Planned Parenthood, and yet now she's making decisions affecting millions of Oregonians and tens of thousands of businesses. But it's not just her. So many Democrat policy decisions leading up to this have been misguided at best, like constantly raising taxes, trying to shove through a carbon tax that would kill our timber industry at a time when we need paper bags instead of those filthy, disease-ridden reusable bags that she's now forcing you to use. The problem, as we all know it, is that government officials can't be held personally liable for making bad decisions, which is why they make bad decisions in the first place. There has to be some pain, and I hope there will be at the next election. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.